like have a couple of slides associated with that. We'll move on after that to discussing a little bit about infrared spectroscopy. Hopefully some of this will be a bit of a review for you. And hopefully this will function actually as a way of helping you organize the fairly disparate information that's involved in looking at infrared spectrum. Okay? A good part of my goal in these lectures, particularly on the spectroscopy, is to help you develop a way of thinking about these things such that it doesn't matter whether you see spectrum, you know, on a standardized exam, some of you took MedCats last week, some of you are going to take them next week, you know, whatever it is that you take them, I want you to have a way of thinking and organizing the information that you know. I mean, I find quite often, particularly with spectra, students really know a lot about where certain things occur, except that they don't always manage that information real well. So it's a matter that that's going to be a good part of my focus over these spectroscopy lectures over the next month or so. Actually, going a little beyond that. And so that's where I'm coming from. I mean, my feeling is that this is a good opportunity for you to help organize your information, develop good habits about these analyses, and then, you know, move on, whether you go into chemistry, biology, whatever aspect of science, I really don't care. It's a matter that we're developing techniques about how to think about the information. Are we talking about some specific pieces of information? Of course, we're always doing that, okay? But really, this is sort of, you know, how to manage yourself managing the information. Okay, let's wrap up discussion of intermolecular forces. I wanted to show you these three structures, which are the structures of aspirin and Tylenol and caffeine, respectively. Now, the nice thing about modern version of organic chemistry books is that you actually have some idea as to what's going on here, hopefully, okay? The majority of the books now have representations of these electrostatic potential surfaces, and they help us have a little bit better concept of what might be going on in terms of how solutes and solvents interact, all right? Is this a perfect model? No, right? It's a matter that many years ago, my major professor at Georgia, at a national meeting, was sort of crazy enough to make a statement, models aren't to be believed, they're to be used. And this was a meeting full of, you know, physical and organic chemists. Everybody was sort of like, why? We believe these things. No, remember, it's a model. I mean, it is not a perfect representation. It is not the item. It is your projection or perception of what might be going on. Okay, so it's something to keep in mind. So as a result, these models aren't perfect. I mean, unless you have some extraterrestrial knowledge of what caffeine looks like at an electronic level, this is not going to be perfect. But what does it do? It helps us organize information. It helps us create correlations between things that we have some intuition about chemically, like what is a dipole, what are the polar regions, what are the negative regions, the positive regions, what regions of the molecule are effectively neutral. Therefore, those are our nonpolar sections of the molecule. Okay. So what this does is this type of representation, again, a model, is something that gives us sort of something to hang our hat on, right? Now, if we take a look, for example, at aspirin, we can see that there's this pretty red region right up here, which is where one of the carbonyl oxygens are, and there are a couple of other oxygens that are in this region as well, okay? And what we see is that this region represents an energy, if I can see it here, of about minus 200 kilojoules, per mole, right? What does that number mean? Well, we establish these surfaces by taking a proton, okay? We take a quantum mechanical model for a proton, just H plus, and we bring it against the surface that we've shrink-wrapped around the molecule, and we analyze at every point on that surface, which is, you know, millions and millions of points, what is the nature of the interaction between the electron density of that molecule at that point and that proton. Is it attractive? How attractive is it? Strongly attractive. Well, if it's minus 198 or so kilojoules, that's a strongly attractive interaction between what is ultimately a relatively negative part of aspirin and the positive proton. On the other hand, if we have an interaction that's repulsive, that's going to be a positive value, and these positive values are up here in the dark blue, and they're on the order of hundreds of kilojoules per mole. And if we take a look at our molecule here, for example, acetaminophen, we take a look right up at that area there, we've got a pretty blue region, okay? And the reason that that's blue is that we have a proton there, all right? So a proton is already relatively positive, correct? All right? And connected to an electronegative element here, an oxygen. Therefore, this hydrogen is going to be fairly positive, and when I bring another positive charge up against it, that's going to be what? Repulsive or attractive? Repulsive, of course. Okay? So these are the extremes, the reds and the blues. Everything else that's in between, essentially the light greens, maybe the yellowish or the orangish colors, it's a little harder to see here. It's a little easier to see if you have it, you know, on your laptop. We can see that there's a gradation between the strong repulsion, for example, proton to proton, versus the relatively strong attraction between a proton and a carbonyl group, which is going to have what? A couple of pairs of hydrogen bond, donors or acceptors? Acceptors, right? Okay, so this interaction is not too surprising, that interaction is not too surprising. Right? Now, what we do with the rest of this is we take a look at it from a very simplistic point of view. We say, okay, we've got really, we can basically take the surface of each of these molecules, all right? We can collect all of the surface area, and we can say, okay, this surface area really falls into overall three categories. Let's say a relatively positive, a relatively negative, and everything in between. But we can make it even simpler than that, because it turns out that knowing whether the surface is positive or negative is actually not quite as critical at times in terms of understanding how molecule A or solute A dissolves in solvent B. It turns out that a lot of the time, just knowing approximately what percentage of the surface is polar versus nonpolar is enough to give us some idea of what's going on. Okay? And there's a couple of ways that we can represent that, but just essentially doing a little bit of counting of the surface area, looking at the polar regions, the nonpolar regions, that gives us the opportunity to say, okay, this molecule looks like the majority of the surface is nonpolar. Therefore, it will be more likely to be soluble in a nonpolar solvent. Okay? And so we can mathematically, or algebraically really, collect this information. Now, one of the things that we can do with this, you don't have this slide, but I'm just showing you to give you a representation of this, is that we can do a little bit of relatively simple bookkeeping. Okay? And this bookkeeping is for a series of compounds that we have not discussed in the lab, but they're nitrobenzene, phenols, and anisoles, all right? And I have the RF values here, for example, in a solvent mixture including methylene chloride, just like we did, and another solvent mixture involving tetrahydrofuran, which we have not used in the lab, but tetrahydrofuran is a relatively simple ether, okay? So it's somewhat less polar, all right? Now, what we can do is we can say, okay, but, you know, you've been talking about surface areas and electrostatics and stuff like that. How do we use this? Well, we can take, for example, the total surface area. We can take the polar surface area. Those are two discrete individual numbers. We can also take the ratio of the polar to the nonpolar or total surface area. We can take the electrostatic potential minimum value. That's the minus 198, for example, that we saw. Or we can take the electrostatic maximum. All right, and that's this value here, and that's somewhere between, let's say, 100 and 300 or 400 kilojoules per mole. And we can determine, can we create a correlation between the observed in the laboratory number for the RF values for a series of molecules and something that we can readily compute? Okay? Now, if you do this exercise, it turns out that there are a large number of correlations because we have lots of molecules. We have two different sets of observations for them, and each of these columns can be used as a regressor against trying to model what the RF value is. Right? So, in other words, we're trying to understand, can we dissect the RF value into a couple of things that are pretty easy for us to compute? Okay? It turns out that doing these kinds of computations are very straightforward nowadays on the average laptop. The software costs less than $50 to do it for a student version of these things. And so it's relatively easy to do this now. Okay? And so if you were to take all of these combinations of X's and Y's, okay, you would find that there are a variety of sort of scattergrams that look like this. So for example, if we want to model the RF value of these molecules in the methylene chloride hexane mixture, which is what was used here, okay, using the dipole moment, you know, that's not very good, right? That's a scattergram, literally. I mean, the best line that we can get out of that effectively looks like a constant, and it's pretty much meaningless because it has an R squared value, or in essence, its fitness is almost zero, okay? So you'd have a much better chance of actually getting a good model for those RF values if you simply tossed a coin, because that would give you roughly a 50-50 chance, right? This model gives you zero chance. Okay, so in essence, that's useless, totally useless. And it turns out that the majority of the equations that you would get, or the models that you would get, looking at dipole moment, looking at surface area, polar surface area, all of these, it turns out, don't do a particularly good job of modeling either the RF value for methylene chloride and hexanes or THF and hexanes. It just happens to be that for this particular set of molecules, it doesn't work that well. All right? So there's no sort of universal model. But the question is, can we get what we would call a local model? And by a local model, that means for the particular small subset of the chemical world that I'm working on right now, can I create a mathematical representation of why the RF values are the way they are if I compute certain values? Okay? And it turns out that the electrostatic potential maximum value versus the RF value gives a regression of about 0.88. Okay? It gives a reasonable line through there. Is this a perfect model? No. But it's a pretty good one. Okay? What it would allow you to do is to go ahead and say, okay, I've got another anisole or another phenol, and it has another type of functional group on it, okay, like, let's say, a trifluoromethyl group. All right? I calculate the values of the ESP min and max for that molecule with the trifluoromethyl group, and let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the value is somewhere around 220. Okay? So what I would do is I would come over for the Emax at 220, go up to this line, and then come over here and say, well, I am guessing, based on the value of about 220, that the RF value in the methylene chloride hexanes mixture for that new molecule, all right, with the trifluoromethyl group, would be somewhere between 0.4 and 0.5. Okay? And I have about an 85% chance, effectively, of having a good guess of that. That's how you would use this. Okay? So if you've not done this type of, you know, estimated values, extrapolated values, and things like that in chemical statistics in the past, this is something that we're going to see more and more of with respect to understanding physical properties. So I wanted to go through that for you, because you can ask the question, well, great, I mean, you compute these things, you can look at those really cool pictures of blues and reds and greens, but what do you do with it? Okay? You can do two things with any model like this. First, you can explain or develop an understanding of the trends that you see and what the underlying causes. The second thing is you can develop a predictive model for something that you haven't tested yet. Okay? And sometimes having an idea of roughly what the range is really, really helpful, because it allows you to plan your experiments. It gives you, you know, the idea of, well, you know, will this solvent or solvent pair be a good one for this? What else do I need to plan on in terms of being able to work with this new molecule? So those are critical aspects to essentially being able to develop these models very quickly. I mean, the calculations for all of these, when my students at DePaul did this, I would say they ran maybe about 40 or 50 seconds per molecule. So, you know, in 10 minutes or less, we were able to crank through the whole set. It took more time, really, to transfer the information into Excel from the tool that we were using to do this than it did to actually do the calculation. So that's pretty good. I mean, in half an hour, you can come up with all of this data, and then it takes you a little while to go into Excel and put all of these regressions together. But if that's, you know, the limiting step in how fast you can do the analysis, that's not bad. Okay, so that wraps up the general discussion that we've been having about intermolecular forces and how we look at them, and effectively what our perceptions are about what we're looking for. And remember, the bottom line is that if you understand what the Lewis structure for your atom is, it will give you a better understanding of even what these numbers mean, as well as understanding what a hydrogen bond is. All right? So you don't want to screw up the fundamentals of what's going on here. Okay? All right, so let's move on and talk a little bit about infrared spectrum. I'm going to skip the first couple of slides of the PowerPoint, because I'm assuming that you all can read what's going on with respect to how these instruments are set up and why we worry about the wavelengths and the frequencies. Let's get down to what is actually going on here. Okay? And this slide reminds you that there are basically three types of spectra that we generally look at that involve a variety of aspects of molecules. Okay, the first of these is called electronic excitation, and that's what we see in either ultraviolet or visible spectrum. Right? All of us, in fact, while we're awake, perhaps even while we're asleep, dream in color, right, know that, in fact, visible and ultraviolet excitations are constantly occurring. We see colors, we see fluorescence, we see bright oranges and greens, we see various types of safety signs that glow in the dark and things like that. All of this is due to excitation in the visible and ultraviolet range, all right? So that's part of the miracle of vision in general. Okay? So we see that. We're going to talk about UV spectra and some visible spectra a little later on in the semester. Right now we're going to focus on vibration, rotation, excitations, because those are the ones that occur in infrared spectra. They also occur in microwave spectra, but microwave spectroscopy is a very, very specific area of spectroscopy. It's definitely for a more advanced analytical course, so we're not going to discuss that here. And we will be talking about nuclear spin excitation when we get into the NMR portion of the course. Okay? So what basically we're talking about is some type of state. So we'll talk about a vibration rotation state at this point for infrared spectra. There's some energy level that is an arbitrary ground state energy level, right? It could be any one. And we add energy into the system and we excite it from the ground state to some excited state. It could be one excited state, it could be multiple excited states. Okay? That's the general paradigm that we're talking about when we discuss this type of spectroscopy. Okay, so let's take a look then at what actually is going on with respect to the physical mechanical body. Okay, that's one of the nice things about infrared spectra. Infrared spectra are actually well modeled in your mind by relatively simple Tinker Toy type of models. Okay, this work was originally done actually in the early to mid 1930s. Okay. And the spectroscopists at that time had the idea, based on an analysis of thermodynamic properties, that there had to be some sort of vibration and rotation and stretches and bends and things like this going on. Okay? Because the thermodynamic properties that they were examining just simply didn't make any sense if bonds didn't, you know, vibrate a little bit, and angles didn't vibrate and rotate and stuff like that. I mean, there was a lot of thermodynamics that didn't make sense if this didn't occur. And in fact, we now know that quite readily that all of these things are going on all the time. For those of you who have, you know, a really good recollection of what you learned in general chemistry, you learned about Brownian motion, right? Random movement of molecules. Well, think of this as sort of an organized version of Brownian motion at an intramolecular level. All right? So in other words, you've got all sorts of symmetrical and non-symmetrical stretches and vibrations and twists and bends and all sorts of these things on an extremely small scale happening all at once. Okay? They're all happening, you know, unless you get down to absolute zero, then you can freeze it out. All right? But before absolute zero, you know, 0.00001 above absolute zero, things are moving around. Okay? And we can use infrared frequencies to excite these things. We can make the stretches a little bit more pronounced. We can make the bends a little bit more pronounced. We can make the rotations of these torsion or dihedral angles a little more pronounced. And we can get these molecules to absorb very small amounts of energy and then note how much is absorbed and at what wavelength. Okay? And that gives us a concept of what's going on. Are these stretches, are these bends, are these rotations, are they in the plane, out of the plane? It's a matter that when we draw benzene rings, right, we always draw these things as being planar, correct? All right, now what I'm going to do next week is show you a simulation of an infrared spectrum of a benzene molecule. And one of the things that you're going to see is that this thing has both harmonic, meaning smooth, and non-harmonic ways of flopping around like this. Okay? Not something that you would necessarily predict just by drawing the structure, right? However, these vibrations exist, and in fact, any aromatic ring, for that matter, has in-plane, out-of-plane, symmetric, and non-symmetric operations. And so we'll take a look at some examples of those as well. Okay, let's take a look at a spectrum just to get an idea of what this looks like. Hopefully you all see this, so it should not be new news as it were. But some of the annotations here may help you, again, organize your knowledge. Okay. Now, usually the absorption bands that we see for a specific functional group occur in the same general region. Does that mean that they're always going to be exactly at 3,000 if it's a CH stretch? No. It could be higher, it could be a little lower. It depends on the concentration, it depends on the solvent, it depends on how the spectrum is being taken. Okay, we're going to go into a little bit more details about that. All right. So if you take a look at the spectrum, you can see we've got a little bump here, we've got a little stronger absorption here, we've got an even stronger absorption there, and a few absorptions here. Okay. Now the general concept of what's going on in the infrared spectrum is that there's a, depending on how you break this up, there's three or four general regions here. All right. In terms of the actual physical process that's going on, there's really only about three. And that is you have a large bond stretching region going from 4,000 wave numbers down to about 1,200 or so, roughly in the middle here, okay? Then we have an angle bending region that basically picks up where the stretching leaves off and goes all the way down. You can have angle bending even down in the 400-500 region. And you get this ring in what we call a torsion region, which is where you get these dihedral torsions. So for example, when a methyl group spins, right, so take the molecule toluene. You have a methyl group connected to a benzene ring. That methyl group spins. Okay, that spin comes in somewhere in this region. Okay, the benzene ring itself, as I was just commenting, has its own bending, twisting, and so forth. That some of that comes in this region. You also get some aromatic stretching and bending that occur in this region as well. Okay, we'll talk about some of those. Now, this happens to be cyclohexanone. This is a landmark absorption here for the carbonyl group of the cyclohexanone. One of the things that you will hopefully acquire as you go through this semester is a working knowledge and an understanding as well as the factual knowledge of what these frequencies are that are sort of these landmarks. Okay, so we'll go through those group by group. All right? So that's generally what the overall picture of an infrared spectrum looks like. Okay. We can go through a little bit of the physics of this, and as much as I love this stuff, I know you guys don't, all right? So I'm not going to go through a lot of the details here. The bottom line, the take-home lesson here is these four points. Stronger bonds absorb at higher wave numbers, okay, larger than constants. Stretches absorb at higher wave numbers than bends or torsions, all right? Again, larger constants there, all right? Bonds to hydrogen absorb at higher wave numbers than others. Okay, so if you have a light atom like hydrogen, all of the X or R to H vibrations occur on the left-hand side or at higher energies. Okay? And generally speaking, polar bonds have more intense absorptions than nonpolar bonds. Right? Well, ultimately what that comes down to is more absorption and a smaller transmission percentage. Okay? This is the take-home lesson in terms of looking at all, this is relatively simple algebra and physics, but it's a matter that you want to know what does this really mean in terms of what these spectra look like, and that's what they mean. Okay. Now let's take a look at these spectrum regions, and as I said, if we look at the mechanical model, we can look at stretches, bends, and then rings and torsions. So that's three ways to break this up. But sometimes it's a little bit better to do it from the viewpoint of another aspect of structure, and that is, what's involved? Single bonds, double bonds, triple bonds, so forth, right? This tends to be a little bit easier way to break these things up. If you look at what is quite often called the hydrogen region, I also call it the light atom region, where you have X connected to H, all of those have higher frequencies in general. So it doesn't matter what's connected to H, it almost always occurs somewhere to the left of about 2,500 wave numbers. Okay, so if you're at 3,600, 3,500, 3,400, 3,200, 3,000, 2,800, all of that region tends to be something connected to hydrogen. It's the vibration that's associated with this heavy atom and this smaller atom connected to it. Okay? So as a result of that, because of the effect of the mass, okay, if you go back to the previous slide, the smaller you make M, or the mass, that's involved in that vibration, the larger the frequency. Okay? So the bigger the frequency difference. Right? So these numbers are larger, and they almost always involve light atom vibrations. Okay? Then there's this little window that occurs just to the right of the light atom region, which is the triple bond region. Okay? We don't get a lot of molecules with triple bonds, but when you do, it's nice to know that these are in a fairly unique and separate spot. I mean, it's really a landmark. You just don't see it all that often. Okay? So these are the triple bonds. So you have the carbon-carbon, carbon-nitrogen triple bonds that occur in there. Okay? Then you have this region that is dominated by double bonds, but can you have some single bonds? Yes, you can. Right? From 1900 down to about 1500. And then below 1500, you get predominantly single bonds, as well as torsion, some angle bending, and combinations of angle, torsion, and also some angle bending and stretching occurring at the same time. Any combination you can think of will generally be available down here in an area that is also called the fingerprint region. So from roughly 1500, some books say maybe 1250 down to 500, give or take a little bit, is the fingerprint region. There's unique sets of mixtures and combinations of all of these bands. Okay? And because of the fact that effectively no two of these look alike, thus the name fingerprint. Okay? All right. So let's take a look at each of these regions on a case-by-case basis, because it is really valuable for you to have this factual knowledge in your head, so that as you're looking at infrared spectra, both as standalone items as well as in conjunction with carbon and proton and NMR, you can get the most information out of it that you can. Okay? So let's start at the highest values here, in the 3500-3600 range down to about 3200. These intense, very polar bonds also have a lot of broadening due to hydrogen bonding. So the OH stretch is in this region. And the OH stretch, for example, from an alcohol is a narrower band than the OH stretch for an acid. Okay? And that's simply because acids tend to make stronger hydrogen bonds than alcohols do. All right? So as a result of that, and we're going to see examples of it as we go through some of the spectra, it makes it relatively straightforward to pick out an OH stretch from an alcohol, which is a fairly narrow and confined strong absorption, from the very broad stretch that you see from an acid. We'll see examples of that. Okay? NH stretches are at a little lower energy. They're generally a little less intense. They're less broad. Of course, you get a doublet of them for the two NH stretches of an NH2 group. And the NH group, whether it is an amine or an amide, only has one. Okay? They tend to be somewhere between, I would say, 25 and maybe about 40% down the page, all right? So if you had from 0 to 100, they're about maybe a third of the way down. Whereas the OH stretch of an alcohol is maybe 60, 70%. And similarly, the OH stretch for an acid is much broader and also very strong. And these are generally less intense, right? Now, if you have a carbon that is sp hybridized, meaning it's an acetylene carbon, basically, okay? That stretch is a pretty strong stretch as well. It comes at about 3,300. It is moderate in its intensity. Again, it's very similar, in fact, to the NA stretch in intensity. It's maybe 30, 40%, something like that. And occasionally it'll happen that if you have a molecule that has this stretch and these, you may not be able to tell them apart, okay? Just from the H region. You may have to look to see, okay, do I have the carbon-carbon or carbon-nitrogen bond for the triple bond down further down here? All right, so that's how you differentiate those two. Then we have the CSP2 hydrogen stretch. These start at about 3,000. Is that a hard number? No, but it's a good sort of landmark spot to look. Because if you have something between 3,000 and 3050, 3070, that range, you probably have either an alkene or an aromatic system. Right? That makes it pretty easy to pick those out. However, here's the kicker on this one. It can be very weak. Okay? It's particularly true, for example, in aromatic systems where you only have one functional group on an aromatic ring. Okay? It turns out that even though you have five CH stretches, you would think that that would make the intensity stronger, right? Because generally, the more often you have a particular feature, the easier it is to pick that out of a spectrum. Generally, that's absolutely true. Except that it turns out that CH stretches in alkenes, symmetrical alkenes especially, and in relatively symmetrical aromatic rings are very weak, because it turns out that that CH stretch is based on the symmetry also, as well as the actual bond itself. So the more symmetric a molecule is in general, the weaker the intensity of the infrared absorption. And these guys can be notoriously weak. We're going to see some cases where they're nice and clear, and then we're going to see some other cases where you can say, Dr. Profeta, how can you tell the difference between that and a little bit of the noise that's in the background? Well, you can't always do that. Okay? So it can be a little problematic, so you've got to be careful with this. Most of the examples that I'm giving you in the slides are differential. In reality, however, some of them can be kind of tricky. Okay? Now, there's a point here that I say that this 3,000 wave numbers essentially divides the sp2 and the sp3. Can you have sp3 hydrogen carbon stretches right at 3,000? Absolutely. Okay, it's possible. You have to be careful, and it's a matter that you just put a question mark as to whether or not that is an sp3 carbon stretch to hydrogen or an sp2 carbon hydrogen stretch. Okay. So there's nothing wrong with putting a question mark there. Just be aware that the two of them can, in fact, overlap somewhat. The nice thing about aldehyde CH stretches is that you get a pair of bands, and they're down at a little bit lower energy. Okay? So if you're looking in the region between 2700 and about 2830 or 50, you almost always see a relatively non-symmetrical pair. It looks like, you know, middle finger and first finger together. There's always just that little doublet there. And they're pretty sharp, too. The strength of that absorbance is variable. Again, 30, 40%, something like that. It's not a super strong absorption. Okay? Now, the caveat for all of these numbers and any other number that I give you is that these are just averaged observations. Okay? There's no absolute with respect to, yep, that's absolutely in it. It's at that number. There's always a little tolerance, because the actual values depend on the concentration of the material, how pure it is, and the method that the sample was prepared and put into the spectrometer. So they have things called Nugel molds. This is basically a waxy oil that can be used for molecules that are really difficult to dissolve. Okay? There are particular types of hydrocarbon oils themselves that are used. You can make what is called a potassium bromide pellet of the material, which essentially is just a solid crystalline material that is scanned through a potassium bromide window. It can be dissolved in different types of solvents, and there are various types of ships. So are these absolute numbers? No. But these are ballpark numbers that you should really be well-versed in, such that when you see the spectrum, you go, okay, that's probably this, that's probably that, that's probably something else. That's the idea. They give you the opportunity to do a fairly quick qualitative assessment as to what's going on. Okay? All right, the next region that is a little lower energy is this triple bond region. The C triple bond N is in the 2200, roughly to 2300 area. It's somewhat more intense. The carbon-carbon triple bond, because of the fact that it has a certain sort of intrinsic symmetry, is also less polar and less intense, and this could be a fairly weak absorption. But the good news is that virtually nothing else occurs in this region. Okay? I mean, it's really hard to find something, at least among organic molecules, that occurs in this region. So these two tend to sort of stick out really easily and let you know, hey, I've got some form of triple bond here, maybe C triple bond N, C triple bond C. Yeah?
Not many things appear in the C triple bond C region? Or
in this general region. All right, so once you get to 2100, up to about 2350, 2400, hardly anything there. Now, interestingly enough, there are times when you actually have to do what's called background correction for your infrared spectra, and all spectrometers do this nowadays, because take a guess at what else absorbs in roughly that region.
something that's a component of air. Two things, actually, that are components of air.
Nitrogen.
N2. N2 actually is almost impossible to see. It would if it had a little bit of non-symmetry, but it's so symmetric that it doesn't appear here. All right? Two other molecules that appear, carbon monoxide, right? C triple bond O, and the non-symmetrical bending of carbon dioxide. Okay? So most of us don't think of carbon dioxide as being non-symmetrical, right? But in fact, it has like a butterfly motion that occurs. C triple bond O that's associated with that occurs in this region. So modern spectrometers essentially eliminate that background for the trace amount of carbon monoxide that's in the air and the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the air. So it's kind of nice to be able to include that. Okay, next region is the carbon-carbon and carbon-oxygen, carbon-nitrogen double bond region. Okay, as you can see, these walk down from higher to a little lower to a little lower, depending on the electronegativity of the atoms that are on the other end of the carbon to whatever double bond. Okay, that makes it pretty easy to sort things out. All right. Once again, our friend, the periodic table, comes to help us have sort of an overview and a generalization of what's going on. So the carbonyl frequency is in the vicinity of 1700. It could be as high as, for example, 1850, depending on the structure. It could be as low as about 1600, depending on whether or not it's an ester and it's conjugated and it has other steric effects going on. So is this an absolute number? No, but this is sort of, you know, the center of mass, if you want to call it that, of the vibrational frequencies for the carbonyl group. Okay? So these three are pretty easy to pick out. This is pretty unusual. I mean, it's just less common. Imines are not molecules that we deal with all that frequently, so as a result of that, we don't tend to see too many of those. But as I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's a quartet of bands that occur between about 1450 and 1600 that are associated with the behavior of the aromatic ring. Okay? This quartet is sometimes really easy to pick out. Then there are other times that you don't have a prayer because of all the other absorption bands that are in that same region. Okay? So don't always expect to be able to pull those out. However, I do have a slide in here and an additional handout that allows you to pick out these particular four bands that occur, and they are pretty much also a form of like a fingerprint for the aromatic. Now, another group that doesn't occur too often, but you don't want to sort of trip over it if you happen to come across it, and that's the nitro group. The nitro group has bands near about 1550 and 1380, and the reason that I even mention these is that they're really intense. I mean, these are bands that start from the top, go all the way down to the bottom, and bounce back up. And it's two of them. I mean, they really, really stand out. How frequently are you going to see nitro groups? Not too often. Okay? I'm relatively unlikely to put one on an exam, but occasionally I get a little crazy and I do. Okay? So here's your forewarning that if you see two really small, you know, really nice pair, very strong bands at about 1550, you know, 1380 to 1400 or so, that's probably a nitro group. All right, so we're going to stop here. We'll pick up with the rest of the spectrum next week. And if I can have some materials away, we will go and take our questions.